Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, September 5th, 2025, and our friend Dimitri Orlov is back with us. Sorry for being late, and we had some sort of technical problems. Welcome back, Dimitri.
Good to be with you once again.
Let's start, Dimitri, with the SEO Summit. What was different when you consider the summit to the previous ones? What was different from what we've seen so far?
Well, I think that there's a basic understanding that there's basically the whole planet minus the disagreeable parts, the peninsula jutting off into the North Sea and a bit of North America, and that planet to come up with a livable arrangement that excludes the disagreeable bits. Is well on the way to doing so. And so that's what's happening, and will continue to happen. That is really the understanding that the whole world has arrived at.
When you look at India, Dimitri, today, where do they see their future? From the behavior, what can we learn from their behavior?
Well, previously, most of India's exports went to the United States, but India has since then realized that this is an untenable arrangement, and India is at this point willing to sacrifice its exports to the United States for the sake of not having to surrender its national sovereignty to Washington's interests. And that is the understanding. The other part of the understanding is that it has to come up with a livable arrangement that involves Eurasian, major Eurasian powers, such as Russia and China, which explains Modi's presence in Beijing. And so those are important factors that drive India at this point.
I think in the eyes of the West, that the coalition or somehow partnership between Russia and China is almost certain. They know that they cannot separate Russia from China. But when it comes to India, do you think that they still feel that they can do something with India, even with those tariffs, 50% tariffs?
Well, they're thrashing, you know. These tariffs are largely fictional. They have caused some amount of economic damage to the United States already. Not sure about the rest of the world, but the damage to the United States is already there. In terms of what they achieved, in terms of changing the political arrangement, probably nothing. This is probably just thrashing behavior on the part of Trump, who thought that he could somehow fix the trade imbalance with the United States by imposing tariffs. It's basically just a foolish idea. And economically speaking, he's a foolish man. There's really not much more to say about it. I could go on about how tariffs don't work, or how they, if the problem, the tariff problem, persists, if Trump manages to get it through the Supreme Court, which is now where the issue will be resolved, then in a year or so we'll have inflation, dollar inflation in the U.S. around 8%, 10% mark. Interest payments on the national debt will eat the entire budget, or most of it, of the federal government. The United States will head further and further in the direction of, a bankrupt nation. All that Trump has succeeded in doing is accelerate that process, because most of the tariffs will be paid for by the American consumer in the form of higher prices. That is definitely the case, and the issue is that the effect will be smeared over almost a two-year period by the time all of that washes through the system. And at the end of that, the fact that, you know, basically everybody in the process and the entire chain, the exporters, the importers, the distributors, the manufacturers, everyone else dependent on imported products, will be further in debt and will have interest payments, because they will be buffering these price changes for as long as possible in order to compete with each other, et cetera. But in the end, we're looking at higher inflation in the United States, and as a result of that, further loss of competitiveness.
I think the case of tariff is somehow different. The Trump administration came in with this sort of policy. Do you think that the administration is using Ukraine as an excuse to put tariffs on India, or it's really related to what's going on in Ukraine and the pressure goes to Russia? How do you feel about that?
Oh, you mean punishing Russia by depriving it of oil revenue because of not being able to force it to capitulate on the Ukraine? That idea? Yeah. That was a good plan. That was an excellent plan. It worked out great. Everybody should give them a slap on the head for that one.
Because it seems that they wanted to put tariffs in India, but they found an excuse out of Ukraine case to do that. Do you feel that way?
No, I don't feel any particular way about it, but it was an idiotic idea. Just foolish. It was just plain foolishness, and it didn't work. So why continue talking about it? It was just stupid.
Yeah. The main question would be, how is that going to influence? How is that going to help the Trump administration? You've mentioned in the last 3 years, we had the value of dollar reducing 107% against the gold. How is that going? How this sort of policy of tariffs would help the economy of the United States domestically and internationally, in your opinion?
Well, it will probably make it much more difficult for the United States to maintain anything like a first world standard of living. Result in a higher inflation, which will impoverish more and more of the population. More and more people will be knocked out of the already sort of very small middle class. And I don't know that it will result in anything else except hastening the process of national bankruptcy, because interest payments will eat up the entire federal budget. Those are the results of what higher inflation and, as a result, higher interest rates. Those are the effects that I expect to see.
Yeah. How do you find the geopolitical outcome of the SCO summit, Dmitry? We see today not only Russia and China together, we saw the leader of North Korea in the first line of, you know, they were walking to each other, they were talking to each other. And how do you find the way that they see North Korea? What is the main objective? What is the main goal of Russia and China keeping North Korea closer to them?
Oh, North Korea is the trigger. North Korea is the reason war. Because there's an agreement between Russia and North Korea. Any attack on North Korea is automatically an attack on Russia. There's an agreement between North Korea and China. Any attack on North Korea is automatically an attack on China. And North Korea made no secret that it will come to the defense of Russia. It already had in Kursk, kicking out the Ukrainians out of Russia's Kursk region. and probably something similar with China. So without it being written down explicitly, there is a triangle, a defensive triangle consisting of Russia, China, and North Korea. And those three countries are the guarantors of peace on the Eurasian continent at this point. Nobody will mess with them.
And she was so, he simply put out the vision of China. He said, you can choose between war and peace, cooperation and confrontation. What are the outcome of those sort of words in the mainstream media in the West? How does the administration in the United States see that? Do you think, are we going to have some sort of escalation, or they understand the sort of the language of China?
Well, they can escalate, they can not escalate, they can, gouge their eyes out. They can do whatever they want in the West. It doesn't change the situation at all. If you watch the military parade carefully, as some people have, it turns out that China has copied all of Russia's responses to the action in the Ukraine. There are new weapons. There's new drone technology, new anti-drone technology. Also, China is keeping up with Russia in terms of various other interesting bits of technology. They seem to have come up with their own version of the Poseidon nuclear-powered autonomous torpedo, which flies through the water at a depth of 1 kilometer and can destroy entire continents by producing tsunami waves, hundreds of meters high, 100 megaton nuclear warhead on that one. So China has its own. It also has its own hypersonic cruise missiles that can take out aircraft carriers at a distance of, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's 2,300, 2,500 kilometers from the Chinese coast, although some of these are air-launched. So that takes out the entire Pacific Ocean as a theater of operations for American aircraft carriers. And there's lots of other technology, drones, anti-drones that they've developed. They're definitely keeping up. And then India seems to be rather effective, as its little equipment test with Pakistan that it held recently has shown. And it has gone back on the idea of buying U.S. weapons and went back to buying Russian weapons and manufacturing. It'll localize some of the production. So basically, the triangle of Russia, China, India, in terms of defensive weapon technology, is there as well. And again, what it means is that the United States won't be in a position to mess with them. It should just pack up its toys and go home.
What was so amazing to see at the SEAL summit was the forces of the countries coming together. Considering last week we had an article on Politico, they were talking about the five important escalations that may escalate drastically in the next 5 years. One of them was Russia and NATO, China and India, and Pakistan and India. And you see all coming together at the SCO summit. So do you feel we had the leadership of Pakistan talking to Putin? They want to improve the relationship between Pakistan and Russia. How do you feel about Russia being somehow mediating or connecting the two, or resolving the problems between India and Pakistan?
I don't think Russia has much to do with that. Russia talks to both sides, is careful to not step on any toes. That's about it. But the important thing about the SCO was the emphasis that was made on indivisible security. There will be no security arrangements for any given country at the expense of any other country. That is the important thing to understand. But the far more important thing that was achieved at the SCO was a level of understanding that SCO members and beyond that BRICS members have to figure out how to integrate their internal electronic systems to basically just completely get rid of the Western ones, the SWIFT and Western banks, get rid of the dollar and the euro seriously. Because, you know, previously the very large consumer market that is the United States was rather important to all of these countries that were new exporting nations. Now, domestic markets in all of these nations that are growing, unlike the West economically, are beginning to dominate. And it is far more important for the SCO and the BRICS members to trade with each other than with the United States or with Europe. Europe is also going to be pretty much crossed out of the equation. So that is really what the emphasis was. Nobody's particularly interested in fighting wars. In fact, it's all about peace, and all of that saber rattling, if you will, all of the military parade, etc. That was all about peace. It was not about war. It is an effort to convince even the most difficult to convince people that a military conflict is a lose-lose, that there's no reason to pursue that path.
I think the main message was that, exactly. And we had the new project of Power of Siberia number 2 going from Russia to China through Mongolia. And Mongolia is just enjoying what's going on. And how important is that, and how is that going to somehow influence Europe, in your opinion?
Europe is, again, the big loser. I mean, first of all, the Europeans said they don't want to buy Russian energy. So that's the present to them. No Russian energy for you. It's all going to China. You don't even have to bother sanctioning Russia. Russia won't sell you anything. And so this is part of the recognition by China that its natural gas, liquefied natural gas sources in the first are not secure because those sea routes are very easily attacked. The American military action against Iran showed that the Straits of Hormuz is not that reliable. So China doesn't want to be cut off from its sources of natural gas, which is very important to it. And Power of Siberia 2 solves that problem, partially. And the rest of it is solved by redirecting the flow of LNG from Russia to China. No more LNG going to Europe. So that's what that means in terms of just industrial might. This is the single largest pipeline project on the planet right now, and it's moving forward.
I don't know if you saw the video. There was a video on Fox News. The reporter was talking about sabotaging the new pipeline before. And it's somehow amazing that if something of that sort happens, Dmitry, it's not about Europe being part of that, Germany being part of it. It's going to be about Russia, Mongolia, and China. Do you think that would bring a war, a major war between the West and the East?
Resulting in a war? Terrorism is rather a different issue, and SCO is devoted to security arrangements to oppose terrorism. I'm sure that given all of the remote sensing technology in place, that pipeline will be guarded. And if you look at a map, there aren't that many places where you can get at it without crossing really rugged terrain over very large distances. So I pity the terrorists who would try to launch an attack like that.
Yeah. Dimitri, Russia and China, do you think that they're going to have their sort of effort to talk with the Trump administration at this stage, at this, because as you mentioned, China is learning from what's going on in Russia, from what's going on in the Middle East, because they know the front line is in Ukraine, is in the Middle East. If not, they're gonna have some sort of conflict directly with the United States. We had it before with the Biden administration. They were talking about, the head of military in Japan said by 2025 they're gonna have a military, a conflict directly with China. I think, do you feel that the main sort of mindset is continuing in the United States, and how China and Russia would think of it?
Well, I think that everybody is Trump well, because the United States may be weaker now than it has ever been, but it's still dangerous, and it's very useful for a nation to have a leader. Even if it's a leader that's hamstrung by the courts and all of this, this legal system that doesn't allow to do anything, it's still useful for the United States to have some semblance of a leader. You know, he may be behaving like a pimply youth who is addicted to social media. He's old enough to go back, you know, into diapers, but at least there's somebody, you know, at least there's somebody to maybe communicate with, maybe talk to. Of course, everybody knows that it's useless to negotiate treaties with whoever the American president happens to be, because he can sign whatever piece of paper he wants, but then Congress won't ratify it, so it won't become. And that has happened repeatedly. So everybody knows that negotiating with the United States is useless. But still, seeing as it's nuclear armed and it has army useless, but still army bases all over the world, it's useful for the United States to have something like a leader type, leaderish person to talk to. So where would Trump come to bet that he stays alive? And Putin actually, in meeting him with in Alaska, said, "So nice to see you and see that you're still alive." That those were pretty much his exact words.
Yeah. How in this summit they didn't talk about Ukraine? I don't know. It was intentionally. They may talk, you know, during the meeting they had. But we haven't heard that much about Ukraine. What was that about? It was because of Russia didn't want to talk about it. It was because of China, or the nature of summit didn't that much connected to what's going on in Ukraine.
Well, it's Russia's problem. The Ukraine is Russia's internal problem as far as the CO is concerned. Putin talked about it because, you know, it's Russia's internal problem. Pointed out that the Ukraine does not have a government that anybody can negotiate with. Any deal signed by that government is null and void. The Ukraine is no longer a country. You know, it has to start with a declaration of independence, because it has destroyed its entire constitutional basis for existence. He invited Zelensky to fly to Moscow, although he might not actually get to the Kremlin. He has to pass through border control at Sheremetyevo Airport, which may recognize him as a wanted war criminal, and then he will go to some place where he will be shoveling snow rather than negotiating deals. So I don't know if he'll fall for that one, but he's not the president of any country. You know, his term has expired. His responsibilities were supposed to have passed to the very fat speaker of the Ukrainian parliament, but somehow didn't. He's still sort of pretending to be the commander-in-chief, although he no longer has that authority. the country can't hold elections because, according to the Constitution, elections cannot be held during a national emergency. Nobody to lift the national emergency, because whoever was responsible for doing that no longer has a job politically. And so the whole thing is just defunct. The Ukraine is done. You can stick a fork in it. But it's Russia's internal problem as far as everybody else is concerned, except for the silly Europeans. Trump has to somehow deal with them, who think that they will send troops to the Ukraine as peacekeepers, which is a completely bizarre idea. Putin has said that any force, that is non-Russian troops, on the territory of the Ukraine are legitimate targets. So if the French or the Germans decide to send troops to the Ukraine, which of course they never will, they'll just keep talking about it, those troops will get destroyed. And that'll be the end of that. So anyway, as far as SCO, the Ukraine is Russia's internal problem. And as far as Russia, Ukraine is no longer even a country. It has no sovereignty. It cannot be dealt with in terms of international law, in terms of treaties or anything like that.
Dmitry, do you understand can we understand what's going on in Ukraine? Who's running the show in Ukraine? Is it Europeans? Is it the United States under the Trump administration somehow is getting the momentum to dictate, to force Ukraine into some sort of settlement? How do you feel about that? How can we understand from what's going on in Ukraine, considering the relationship they have with Europeans and the United States?
Well, as I just said, the Ukraine doesn't exist, so it can't make any deals with regard to territories or anything like that. Putin has spelled it out. Basically, what has to happen in the Ukraine is a national referendum on whether a certain region wants to stay with Kiev or join Russia or be independent or join Romania or whatever. Doesn't really matter. But it's the people who have to do it. Not Donald Trump, not the government in Kiev. They have nothing to do with it. The problem is, to hold a national referendum, first you have to have elections. Mm-hmm. And to have elections, first you have to lift the national emergency. And to lift the national emergency, you have people who have the authority to do so, who don't exist. So there's nothing to be done. All that happens, keeps advancing. At some point, the Ukrainian military will dissolve. There will be a bit of a civil war, and then things might move forward. But that's really the way it has to be. It has to move. There are no other alternatives, as far as I can see.
To sort of end to the conflict in Ukraine, one of them is escalation. As I put, literally the title of this talk today is Putin's last move, Russia's final strike. The Russia's final strike, in your opinion, is some sort of attack on Ukraine, or to just bring everything down, and politically I'm talking about, or they're going to have some sort of understanding with the West and with the Ukrainians? From what's going on so far, what's your take on that?
Russia continues to find a way at what it sees as its own sovereign territory, and also creating a buffer zone to provide for its own security against attack. And that is all that Russia is doing. And in terms of escalation, you know, that's a fancy word, but there is no escalation. There's just ongoing, which sometimes moves faster, sometimes moves slower, liberating those territories, of eliminating the Ukrainian military and whatever mercenaries that are sent in there, of destroying NATO's military potential, because it's all being squandered on the Ukraine. That's all that's happening. As I said, there's nobody in the Ukraine for Russia to make deals with. And the Europeans and the Americans are not even part of the picture as far as Russia is concerned. The Ukraine is Russia's internal problem. The more people interfere, the longer the conflict will go on. But it will come to an end eventually. And since the Ukraine as a sovereign nation no longer exists, you know, this is a process that will take a few days to resolve.
Do you think that Russia is totally ignoring the market of Europe in the process in the future, or they're still thinking of having a relationship with some European countries that may somehow expand through the western part of Europe?
Well, Russia tries to have relationships with certain European countries. Fitz was in Beijing. I saw him there on the podium. This is a small Western European country that tries to have its own relationship with Russia, Hungary as well. Various other European nations are not as capable of pursuing their own policy with regard to Russia, but they all have certain limits. You see, they are not sovereign. European nations have surrendered their sovereignty to Brussels, and Brussels is very badly run by incredibly incompetent people like Ursula von der Leyen, like that Estonian wonder who doesn't even know who won World War II. So it's not really reasonable for Russia to pin its hopes on a constructive relationship with Europe at this point. Also, as the Europeans are absolutely dead set. I can't see myself. Can you hear me still? Hello?
I can hear you, Dimitri.
Okay,
everything's
good.
Fine.
Oh, okay. Keeps fading in and out. But in any case, since Europe is dead set on destroying its industrial capacity, and as a result of that, it won't be much of an importer of Russian products, there isn't really much of a reason to devote a lot of attention to Europe. And so Russia is absolutely focused on its Asian partners. Russia is pursuing a policy of enhancing its stature with Eastern countries, with China, and with ASEAN countries, and pretty much ignoring Europe.
Yeah, actually, Putin said today or yesterday said that not only east and west of Russia, but to the south. And we've seen in the SCO summit, they've invited Armenia and Azerbaijan. I think the whole point about these two countries was the sort of conflict and the importance of the projects going on in that region. Was that the case?
Well, inviting Armenia and Azerbaijan was inevitable because they're members. And so that doesn't mean that those two countries, Armenia especially, have any particular significance to the overall. Armenia is a tiny country that is of interest pretty much only to Russia because there are so many Armenians living in Russia. More than half of the population, Armenian population, lives in Russia, not in Armenia. Same thing with Azeris. Azerbaijan is really only interesting to Russia because, you know, there are lots of Azeris in Russia. Both of those countries are in a lot of trouble. They'll have to talk through their problems. But in the larger scheme of things, they're just not that important. Sorry, I lost you. I can't hear you.
Yeah, I didn't know that Armenia and Azerbaijan are part of the SCO summit. I yeah, that was somehow amazing because they were not, we were not talking about them that much before these sort of escalations, this sort of conflicts happening in these two countries. Yeah, it somehow, yeah, the ignorance on my part. But Dmitry, we had before, we have some sort of problem with the connection, but I'm trying to wrap it up as soon as possible. Maybe next time we can move to another panel to use it and maybe having less problems that we're witnessing right now. Dmitry, when it comes to the Israeli attack on Yemen, we had Israel attacking the prime minister of Yemen and killing, assassinating all of his cabinet members together with him. The United States went to the Red Sea. They didn't do it before leaving the Red Sea. Why did Israel decide to do that, in your opinion?
Well, fits the pattern. Israel tries to assassinate the leaders of various countries. Like, Israel basically feels that it can do whatever it wants. It's a terrorist country. It launches terrorist attacks on other countries. Now, what it means is that Yemen will need a new leadership, new cabinet. But how many millions of Yemenis are there left to form that cabinet from? I don't think they have much of a problem.
Thank you so much, Dmitry, for being with us today. Before wrapping up, tell us about your latest piece on your website and how can people support your work?
Well, my most recent piece is on how the West is no longer to be found. You can look for it with a torchlight, and it's just not out there. And that became abundantly obvious in the events taking place in China over the past few days. And I wrote about what that means. So I will be next. I think I will launch into a discussion of how the East is which is where all of human civilization came from, is becoming the center of human civilization, and how this is in some ways inevitable and what it means.
Thank you so much, Dmitry. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you.